Let's give it up for Dr. Jared Ball once again, family.
So we'll give Dr. Ball a moment to have some water.
No, let's go.
Okay, no problem. So he took his sip, so he's ready to go. A lot of information that was presented and brought forth to us. The information that he brought forth was something that could spark critical thinking, something that may perhaps challenge what we may have already came in the door with. So, with that being said, now is the time where if you have a question, you can be able to pose that for Dr. Ball. We do ask, however, if you have a question, then please state your question. Some have even said, state your statements in the form of a question, all right? Because he's already given the lecture. But nevertheless, also, we have a mic that is going to be coming around if you do have something to say. So please use the mic, speak into the mic, so we can have the most quality recording possible, all right? So with that being said, does anybody have any questions for Brother Ball? All right, hands already going up. All right.
So, I'm not good at this, so y'all gotta pass the mic around. So
I do a lot of blogging, a lot of writing, and I think that I was very popular a couple of years ago and very well liked on these internet streets and et cetera, when I wasn't as well researched and I wasn't as well tuned in to what I was actually, you know, going through, what black people were actually going through, and I started to really understand that, right? So I'm finding now that I'm being made out to be a crazy person by looking at these things and digging deeper and asking other questions and being more informed. And the more radical my thinking gets, the more that I'm seem to being ostracized. And channels deleted, being banned on Facebook. My IP address is banned. As soon as I see my picture, it's a wrap. How do you deal with this?
Because you just said,
like when you got up there, like, because when Chris introduced me to you, I went to your YouTube page and I'm like, this man should have a million subscribers.
I guess one way I deal with it is not by being unpopular. So I don't get, you know, I don't have a lot of views, I don't have a lot of followers, subscribers, and I think that, you know, so that allows me to avoid some of the hostility and struggle. I think that's part of it. The other part, the point you made at the beginning about being more popular the more uninformed you think you were, is I think important, that we always have to remember popularity is political, and there is a mutual exclusivity between popularity and substance. In other words, fame and celebrity and popularity do not equate to being correct, do not equate to being substantive, and often mean the opposite. So a lot of reason why people are popular is because they are offering something that isn't challenging, isn't critical. The other way I deal with it, honestly, is that. I mean, so we were talking beforehand, I approach all of this initially as someone who engaged all this as an activist. As someone who is far more hostile and angry than maybe he presents himself right now. So I'm furious at the way things are. And I almost don't care what people say or think, or what I want is someone, as we were talking about before, I want to challenge someone to say something substantive about what I've said is wrong, or what anyone is saying is wrong. So I rest on that. I just say, look, it's something. Look, I don't even think I'm giving a good answer. Let me also say this. Sometimes it is frustrating to see people rip off my work and not give me credit.
I've seen it.
Oh, it happens all the time. I mean, it happens to everybody all the time. Mm-hmm. Or to see people not acknowledge your argument as they make another one that is wrong, even though they know you exist and could include you in. I mean, so there is frustration. So part of it is trying to be organized or work as part of a collective so that you're not out here by yourself. I don't know.
It's good enough for me.
But it is a challenge. I mean, it is a challenge. That's a real problem, actually. You know. And then also to think about, look at all the people that I honor who, I mean, you said what you said about how many people should be looking at my YouTube page. I mentioned George Jackson. I think George Jackson should be the first name on everybody's tongue every morning of every single day while these conditions exist. And that man was as brilliant and as real a revolutionary as ever has been produced, and has been suppressed intentionally to the point where it's hard to find. You can go anywhere and people at least know Dr. King's name. And my argument has been he is the most known and least understood person in the world, second maybe only to the historical Jesus Christ. But nobody's talking about George Jackson. And that to me is, so I'm like, if they can suppress George.
I had to take blood in my eye from his hands today in order to get out the door.
Great door.
So I'm grateful that it's still going around.
He is, to me, that's the man right there, and that's in his analysis and what he did with it, and his and he was right about buying power, which you were. Anyway, sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, my name is
Sassine.
I was wondering
if
you elaborate more on some of the myths or misquotes that people like Claude Anderson may have used in his book because it's power anonymous and things like that.
Well, I don't have the quotes in front of me, but even my dear Amos Wilson, Blueprint for Black Power, that's a book I've studied deeply in for years. It's the only thing that I'm saying that they think that they got wrong, and I'm not. And as I was saying to these folks before, I realize how that sounds when somebody like me, who am I to say that I think that they're wrong on this point? Just this point. I'm only going to argue this point. They simply refer to those numbers. That's all. They talk about the buying power as if it's real, and they talk about it as if we are just Dr. King, Malcolm, all made this mistake. Talk about it as if the reports that were initially coming out of the Commerce Department were accurately reflecting the money floating around the black community. So that's why all these questions about the money rotating X amount of times in the community. Marissa Baradaran, whose book came out last year that everybody should read. We have interviews with her. This is the I hate the way the site is showing up on this, but the 10 years of work is here. And in her book, The Color of Money, Black Banks and the Racial Wealth Gap, offers a lot of details as to not only how banking works, how policy impacts banking and the value of money and how wealth is created, but specifically not talking about buying power, but addresses the point that we have never had the money in the community that people think we have had. And she goes back to the Freedmen's Bureau with Frederick Douglass having to use his own money to bail out the Freedmen's Bank because he just didn't have enough money because black people don't have any money. So when you're telling poor people to invest and save, or in this case, spend and buy, I mean, you have to think about the logic. Just simply put, without even getting into the detail, the logic itself doesn't work. Poor people spending to create wealth for poor people. On its face, doesn't work. So I asked Marissa in one of our interviews, I said, you know, one of the questions I've been asking for a long time is, has there ever been a point in black American history where if every black person operated on the same logic and with the same understanding of our money and used it to invest in our banks and buy our, you know, businesses, support our business, would that have ever overturned the inequality that we face in this country? And she said, not even close. And the fundamental problem is because you're asking the wealth to be generated by poor people who don't have any wealth to start with. And wealth is created by wealth. That's it. You need wealth to create wealth. You can't. So I feel like I'm not getting it for you. Go ahead, ask another one. No, we'll follow up on that.
It seems like a standstill then now, right? So where do you go from there?
So that's my point. That's why I started. I don't know.
You wasn't here for that.
No, I'm saying because you said organizationally and things like that, so.
I don't know. The reason I say it that way is because, one, this is where we get into a lot of ideological political differences, and two, we're speaking publicly. And I'm a firm believer as a former, someone I think is a former real activist. Now, I don't think what I do now is that anymore. You got to be in rooms with people you know and work with on a regular basis and have made commitments to and are off the record to have those answers be developed. Every speech that Malcolm gave, again, since this is his birthday, was the overt symbolic representation of what was happening behind the scenes that was not being discussed, which is why people to this day are confused about him. So the reason I stay with that vague answer is because people who stand up here in front of cameras and microphones and who are individuals not representing an organization, who start spouting, this is what we got to do, they're either lying or they're just wrong or they're just frauds. So that's what I'm saying. Like, the basis of what is happening in this space already, that's what has to be built upon. And after these community discussions take place, the mic's got to get unplugged, the camera's got to get turned, the phone's got to get left in the car, people got to go through, for lack of a better phrase, rites of passage with each other as organized members of a movement. Then you'll figure out all the solutions. That's the only way it's going to happen. So I know how it sounds, but that's why I said from the beginning, I'm only trying to get rid of this one myth, because your point is right. It is a catch-22. That's why you have to have a political movement that emerges and forces some real change. And that's why there has to be a fight. And that's why I don't like getting into it, because people don't, a lot of times I'm misunderstood or people don't want to hear that, but that's the reality of the situation.
People don't want to hear that.
I don't want to hear it, because I don't want to fight either. I got two little beautiful girls. I'm trying to chill. But if we want to be free as a collective, this book is really important, because what she does is she shows how it's really the elite organizing themselves with their wealth and their politics to set up policy to manipulate who gets what money and who is kept out of the money. So one of the points that she and I talked about that was in her book during one of our interviews was that, you know, we hear all the time that, and this is one of the points that I think Anderson and Wilson have missed, the money has to circulate in our community. But that's not how wealth gets generated. Wealth, see, and this is why, again, I get hated on in some of my, and I understand, I agree actually. That's why we have a hate awards. You should all listen to our hate awards, our annual radio show called the Hate Awards, where we critique ourselves and all the things that prevent revolution. It's like a fun, but it's hateful, but it's fun. And I hate on myself, because one of the things, you know, I love reading Karl Marx and all of them, but I'm very rooted in the African-centered traditions. But where Marx, again, was correct is that if you read his book, Capital, what makes wealth capital or capital wealth is its movement. It has to move. So circulating dollars in the black community is not how you generate wealth, because what generates wealth is when that money gets taken out of the community, invested in wealth-generating business or enterprise that then would get dumped back into whatever community. That's where the wealth... So white people don't just circulate their money in white communities. They invest in everything. That's why if you look up the chief institutional investors in every major thing, anything you own, they're private equity groups that own everything. And Vanguard is one of the leaders. They own everything from Apple to AT&T to Verizon to Netflix to Amazon. They're the chief institutional investor in all of these. Why? Because what is a private equity group? A group of rich people who pool their money and put it all over the place to circulate it into everything. They can't just leave it in their little clique. They're sending it everywhere. That's why they got hands in everything. That's how you generate wealth. Circulating dollars in a black community might at best create a few well-to-do black business people, and that's it. And that's not enough. Yes, sir.
My name is Shabazz, and one of the things I want to ask you about is like about banks. Like mm-hmm. me myself, I really don't like using banks a lot, mm-hmm. just because if it shuts down, look at all your money and things of that nature.
Well, not technically. Technically, it's supposed to be insured, and you'll get your money back. But
well, that's what they say. But but I want to know: do you feel as black people, you know, African, we should all bank with a black bank, or do you feel as black banks really won't help the preservation towards black liberation?
So they won't help. And it's not because they're black, and it's not because black people are bad. It's because banks, number one, are not here to help people spread wealth. They're here to create wealth for wealthy people. So banks collect people's money and then take that money and invest it and make money for themselves and for primary stockholders of the banks and the major people who have all the big investments in the bank. Go ahead.
And this, this was like some of my, another question that
sure.
I feel as if black people, revolutionaries, that when we get our checks, things of that nature, keep a little bit in a bank, keep our money where we know it is so that if it does, something happens, something goes down, we all have a pool of money that we can quickly grab. Would you say that's more helpful than to have, than for everybody to put their money in a bank?
I don't know what, honestly, I don't know if that would make much of a difference. Because if you're talking about a point in society where banks are shutting down and closing down, mm-hmm. the money you have isn't going to be worth anything anyway.
Right.
And you know, we've been long watching the move away from a cashless, move to a cashless society anyway. So there's not gonna, they're trying to get to the point where there is no cash.
Right.
So there won't be, but the point is, even if you have the cash is, the value of the money in your pocket is politically determined. It's a social construct.
Right.
So as Noam Chomsky points out, his point is that there's a virtual parliament that runs the world where major investors using high-speed investment computing technology are investing in things all over the world every nanosecond. And that is what is, in fact, making the decisions about politics around the world. Where do people invest? So a few years ago, when people got upset with what Argentina was doing, all the rich people pulled their money, the economy collapsed, and everything fell to pieces, and the people who were asking questions like you were like, I might have a few dollars squirreled away, or pesos, or whatever they're working on, whatever, what was their, whatever the currency is, but it's not worth anything.
Right.
And then when you, then you have to take that money and go somewhere with it, and someone has to agree to give you something in exchange for that money. That's a whole social contract. So if you want my water and I'm looking at you, that dollar in your pocket isn't worth anything to me. You can't have my water.
Right.
So I just want to make one point. This is George Jackson's quote that I found. It's on the blog I keep here. So what is to be done after a revolution has failed, after our enemies have created a conservative mass society based on meaningless electoral politics, spectator sports, and 3% annual rise in purchasing power strictly regulated to negate itself with a corresponding rise in the cost of living? What is to be done about an expertly scientifically calculated contrapositive mobilization of an entire society? What can we do with the people who have gone through the authoritarian process and come out sick to the core? There will be a fight. That's my man. I'm so amped right now. I wish I was still going to the gym. I feel like I just lift this whole thing out the damn. Excuse me. Sorry. I get amped with George. Because look, that's what he's saying. And when he said, he had that other quote I sent out the other day when he was talking, when they gave Kendrick a Pulitzer. And people got all happy. George had a line, he said something about, we don't want awards. He said, when revolutionaries see something like awards, he said, if we don't get happy, we dig graves. Whoa! Now, George scares me, but that's why our standards have to be high. We need to be uncomfortable.
Right.
We need to be uncomfortable. I was trying to look. I debated briefly the president of Industrial Bank in D.C.
Hey, that's what I think.
You can.
I don't like industrial. That's why I keep my money out of
here. I'm not judging you. This is not a judgment of you. What I'm saying is, you can find the video and the audio on this blog and listen to it and check it out for yourself. I would argue either he was being honest and lying, or he just doesn't understand the concept. But what he was saying is, first of all, I show you on here somewhere, I show you how all the black banks combined wouldn't even make the top 15 of the top banks in the world. So even if you took all the black money and all the black banks and somehow put them under our control and we were the governing body and we said we're going to save our people, we would realize we don't have enough. And that what we are competing with are people who have resources at 100,000 times what we're dealing with. There is no catching up, is the point I'm getting at. There is no, the imbalance that exists, in other words, there can only be a 1% if there is a 99. So the 1% constantly recreate the 99 so that they can stay in the 1. It's the same thing when you get on a plane. I'm only in first class because you're in coach. When I used to go to the club, literally, the rope would be right here. And they would say, you're in VIP, and I'm on this side. We're the same. But the only reason I'm over here and you're over there is because I'm over here. When I'm driving my girls to their soccer games and they're looking at these big houses that we never see near where we live, I'm like, don't get excited or don't get jealous. Get angry. They're thieves. Seriously, the only reason they live in that house is because we can't. That's the simple reality. So Industrial Bank is saying, so what really happens with Industrial Bank and black banks is a few black bankers make some money. But what do? They don't have enough to reinvest back in the community. They're not able to buy up houses and give it to you for free. They're not able to invest in black businesses to the point where you could compete with a Walmart. By the way, remember, white businesses can't compete with Walmart. Like, we forget, my wife had to take a job in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, and driving out there, you almost forget how poor white people are because we're stuck in this. White people in this country are broke as hell.
Right.
Broke as hell, convinced that they're better than us because they're white.
Absolutely.
They don't have any money. So what I'm saying is they're trying to make it seem like we can do something to change our poverty. They can't even do it, and they're white. I mean, my joke used to be that white men have to be the most depressed people in the world because they're told from day one this country is all for them. And then they still end up poor. Like we all know on some level, this ain't our place. So on some level, I think we rationalize, like, I'm not supposed to get it any better than this. And I think sometimes that hurts us. But they're like, from day one, everything this white boy is told is, this is your world. And then he ends up poor, living in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. No wonder he's miserable and on meth and all this other stuff.
Right.
My bad. That's why Atlanta, the show Atlanta was talking about Florida Man, right? Y'all see that? Anybody watch Atlanta?
Yeah. Great.
So I enjoyed the lecture on what I heard in the first hour, unfortunately. But I heard about it an hour and a half ago, so that was good.
I'm just messing with you.
So tell me more about Voice Watch, because I was becoming a fan.
All I was really saying, I'm sorry, yeah. So you know who got...
Is there any legitimacy to his...
No.
None?
Zero. Zero.
Zero?
Zero. Now, why? The simple answer is, one, because he completely misrepresents the concept of buying power and claims that because he has an economics PhD that he's an authority. One comment about PhDs. I don't know where I got this joke, but I say it all the time because it's true. You go to undergrad and you think you know everything. You go to graduate school, get your master's, you realize you don't know anything. Then you go to get your PhD and you realize that nobody knows anything. PhDs, there is something to be impressive about. I mean, there's something of value in going through a, you know, organized study, disciplined study. But it does not guarantee that you are an all-in-all expert. And what those of us who get PhDs should know more than anything is to be humble, because you should know that there are so many competing ideas and approaches, and wow, you can't read everything. So that's why I'm saying, when people with PhDs stand up here and they act like they know, and people without PhDs, anyone who acts like they know everything is a fraud. And anyone who tells you to pay me for a solution to your economic problem is hustling.
Now,
I'm starting with, that's my baseline beginning point. The real point is he misrepresents buying power and tells you and repeatedly says that buying power is real, that black people are only poor because we don't save and invest properly, and that if you spend hundreds of dollars on my course, I will teach you how to get $1 million, he said in one of his videos. I can't express to you how low of an opinion I have of that. Number one, because it's a completely false statement. There are not millions of dollars waiting for people if they take the right course from Boyce Watkins, who, by the way, is on the low selling his company to a white media corporation and fronting for Asian and white PR specialists who hire him to do what he's doing, to go into the black community and spread this nonsense.
And to add to that, he don't have $1 million. He lives right down the street from me on 47th Street, Chicago. I know exactly where he lives. I know where he shops.
And I looked up, and I did look. Now, to even be more clear, I looked up his dissertation because he kept talking about his PhD in economics.
You get that Save-A-Lot or 47th and Cottage.
I did not read his entire dissertation, but his dissertation is about investing. And there's nothing that I read in the chapter overview or in the first few pages that suggests that he is either dealing with these issues or is qualified to deal with these issues. And then I'll also say one more thing. Having gone through a PhD in media studies, having gone through a master's in Africana studies, I can say with confidence that there are a lot of people with a lot of degrees who say a lot of things that are not substantiated by fact. There's a lot of politics as to who gets what degrees and who gets put in what place with what degree. In fact, that book, and that's why I also say, I put all my stuff out here so people can look at it, review it, critique it, whatever you want. It's all for free. You don't have to pay me nothing. I have a support link up there, but you don't have to click it to get nothing from me. I dare people to read my research and tell me I'm wrong. Because the top economists in the world, right, or on this issue in the world right now, co-signed my work finally. And even if they didn't, I know I'm right. Because for 10 years I've been doing this work and I've been reaching out to people. I've reached out to so many people saying, please look at this. Because I'm not so smart that I'm the only one to see this. I can't be the only one to have done this work. And economist after economist after economist after economist have told me, you're right, no one else has done this work. I don't even know what you're talking about. Those are the three responses I get from economists.
So how do we follow you?
imixwhatilike.org. Or at imixwhatilike. And imixwhatilike, the I is not meant to be singular. It's a borrow. I borrow it from Steve Biko, who did I Write What I Like in South Africa. So I mix what I like is just an updated multimedia concept of journalism and media practice. Please check it out. And I have to say, though we were talking earlier, I don't agree with her on things too much outside of this particular issue. But as I have here, Yvette Carnell's breakdown of Boyce Watkins is perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Not now. You can go to the website and look at it whenever you want.
Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
So I know you say you don't have the solution. Mm-hmm. I'm listening in between, you know,
sure.
And I heard some
before solution. Between running everything.
Yeah, I've heard some solution, some ideas at least, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking this: what do you believe that debunking this $1 trillion myth will do?
That's a good question. That's a really good question. What I hope it will do is so this is the, again, I have all these fantasies, revolutionary fantasies. One thing I hope to do, if this myth is destroyed, people will immediately have to confront, I think, the reality of the situation. So my joke used to be, and I think still is I want everybody to adopt all of the myths that are told to us from day one. Mm-hmm. America's free, equal, civil rights solved all our problems, black people are their own, you know, just pull your pants up, change your name. What else they tell us? Get real hair. Whatever they tell us we're supposed to do that's holding us back. Pull your pants up.
Right.
You know, for a day or two, we're not going to buy rims and hair. We're not going to buy weed. We're going to be the first person to the bus stop. We're going to be out there in our suits and our dresses, and all our names are going to be Susan and Michael and Anthony, and there's not going to be any Kwames and all this other nonsense. We're going to do all of that. We're going to be out there by lunchtime. We would have our George Jackson Revolution because everybody would see immediately all of this stuff is nonsense. And I'm not poor because I'm lazy. And I'm not poor because my hair is this way. And I'm not poor because my name is Nzinga. And I'm not poor because my pants are saggy. And then we would throw all of that away. And then the fight that George Jackson was saying we need to have would happen.
So with that being said, right?
Yeah.
So, in fact, interesting because you can quote whoever you want to quote. This is African Center Space, but we have a lot of logic here. And we question, critique everything. Mm-hmm. And if my saying is, what's African centered is for what's best for black people.
Right.
So it don't matter who it came from. So
yeah.
So I think that's in itself is worthy of saying this in itself is a is not the solution, mm-hmm. but a part of the solution,
sure.
by breaking down the myth, because we live our lives a lot of myths.
That's right.
And you've mentioned many myths. Even to us, many of us believe that white people is equivalent or tantamount to rich, and black people is equivalent and tantamount to poor. Mm-hmm. White people equivalent and tantamount to slave owner, mm-hmm. and black people equivalent and tantamount to slave, mm-hmm. and criminal, mm-hmm. and reject, and all these different things, all these different myths that are in our minds, mm-hmm. that perpetuate the problem. Mm-hmm. So I would suggest, mm-hmm. that debunking the myths, mm-hmm. in and of itself is a part of the solution.
I hear you and I appreciate that. I'm glad that's recorded, and I hope other people hear that are the first to hit me up on YouTube or elsewhere and hate on me. No, but I got that. I appreciate that, and I agree. I was only trying to be clear, because often, the first question is, what are we supposed to do then? You just shattered this myth. Mm-hmm. By the way, my myth is only one of the 10 or so that are included in this report that address all of the problems we have in understanding our economic conditions. So mine is just one little small piece of this broader report that talks a lot about, you know, how we misunderstand celebrity, how we misunderstand reports and financial data, and so on and so forth. And there are a bunch of other myths, some of which you just outlined, that need to be dealt with as well.
Right.
But, so I just wanted to be clear that I'm not trying to say once you read my work or hear my presentation, you will now know what to do to go get free. I'm just trying to say, when someone says to you, we have buying power, there needs to be a critique of that, and it needs to be discarded as part of the solution. That, I would argue, is the solution I'm offering. Get rid of this as a solution.
So, is there a way that we can use these numbers in terms of, you know, like influencing, you know, like our ideologies? Because I look at Burkina Faso, you know, with Sankara. I look at, you know, NJM with I think his name is Bishop. And is there a way that I guess we can replicate?
Or Maurice Bishop, the New Jewel Movement.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The Jewel Movement. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is there a way we can replicate, I guess, our victories? And even, you know, reading like Emil Cabral and his like theory, I think it's his theory of, I think it's reality. Is there a way that we can apply some of these theories to here and now?
I don't know. When I think about those people and those ideas, the first thing I think of is the struggle here has to be the people that I point to for starting in this country are people like George Jackson, Malcolm X, Kwame Ture, Assata Shakur. Only because they're starting here with you know. What I think. So yes and no. I mean, so, you know, one of the critiques I have about starting with continental Africa as the you know, Cabral is brilliant, mm-hmm. but he had a land base that we don't have. He had an identity base that we don't have, in the sense that he had there was a clearer understanding then of whose side everybody was on. Mm-hmm. We aren't even clear that we are in a fight.
Right.
We keep having people telling us that we have been included, or we are part of this thing now, or we have more people reaching out to black faces to be, you know, that's why Kwame Ture said black visibility is not black power. More black people are popping up in spaces. More more propaganda is being produced to suggest that we don't have the problems that we have, or that we are the problems that we have. And so So I don't know. The only thing I keep coming back to is we need to start with that form of organization. We need to develop the same kind of. See, I don't think that the Panthers and I don't think that the Black Power movement. I don't think that they were wrong, and I don't think that their politics or ideologies were wrong. I think that the most powerful state in human history obliterated them, and it's not that they were wrong. We just have to rebuild those movements. So I think everything that has ever been done should be done again.
Oh.
Everything mm-hmm. that has ever been done should be done again. And in the process of developing that, we'll find out the specific answers. I don't know. I don't know. I will say one more. Let me say one more thing about that. This is where, again, I agree with Yvette and Antonio, that there does have to be a political movement. That there has to be a movement that says we want the goods and services that we produce to be redistributed to the rest of us, regardless of whatever you claim it is that we need to do. So the fact that I exist as a human being in this country should mean I get X amount of X amount of X amount. It shouldn't be that I have to have gone through all of this first or somehow prove myself. In other words, the report they just showed the other day, what they say, since 1980, from 1980 to 2015, the Pentagon says it has lost $23 trillion. That's the annual GDP of the country. So if you think about every single good and service and transaction for one single year in this country, the money generated from that, every time you buy something, every time someone buys something or sells something or interest is made, that goes towards that $23 trillion. They've lost that. What does that mean? What does that really mean?
It means they got some big guns.
Well, I was going to say something different, but maybe you're right. I was going to say that means that somebody else got that money.
Yeah,
uh-huh. But it's only as good as you've been able to protect it.
Say that again.
It's only as good as you've been able to protect it, right?
Say it again.
Oh, I see what you're. I see what you're saying. That's right. So they do have big guns. You're right about that.
Yeah. So what's the most problematic? Not because the money is generation, because the fear and the threat.
That's right.
Of them being able to take yours.
That's right.
Absolutely.
You understand what I'm saying?
That's right.
Absolutely. So. Yeah, so I guess my question...
But let me just finish that point real quick. Don't give up the mic. I just want to finish the point very quickly that my point is, if $23 trillion can be lost by the Pentagon, that means that's our tax dollars being lost by the Pentagon. If that means we're on a year, this country every year generates $23 trillion as part of its GDP, mm-hmm. That means none of us should have to do one single thing more to have all the things that we need to be healthy, happy, and sustainable. You see what I'm saying? There shouldn't be. I told my daughter's school the other day, said we're going to have a car wash for Puerto Rico. I prohibited her for participating. Not because I don't care about Puerto Ricans, but because I said I don't want anybody starting this nonsense with my daughter at an early age that we have to wash cars to get what we need when we have already contributed to $23 trillion. We have already put in the work. Give me some of that money. And that's why I'm saying we need a political movement. The money already exists. I'm not doing another car wash. And when we were at Dick's Sporting Goods and the dude was like, would you like to contribute to cancer or whatever? I was like, hell no. And he said, why, you don't care about the cancer? I was like, of course I care about cancer patients. I got cancer in my family. Dick's is a multi-billion-dollar store. I just spent $80 on a ball and some socks and a... You want me to give more money? I just helped generate billions for this dude. And I just helped generate $23 trillion for this country. Don't ask me for one more penny. Not one more. I'm not giving to Red Cross. I'm not giving to nobody. The money already exists. We need a political movement that says, give us some of it. They're Puerto Rican American citizens. What I got to do a car wash for?
That's right.
Right.
Same. Look at what's happening in Baltimore. What do we need? What do people need to be out in the streets for? Give me the money. Fix my city. Mm. We have already done it. We have already contributed to it.
Right.
So that's why when people like Boyce say, now give me some more money so I can tell you how to make more money for yourself, I'm like, you know you're lying. Mm-hmm. You know you're lying. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Really, my bad.
Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
That was
my point. No, in all seriousness, though, but yeah, you say this political movement, like, you... Again, I think it's a notion of asking, right? You know, it's a notion of asking. And I think that, I guess my question would be, to some extent, you know, do we devalue what others value? Because if you value something that other people value, that gives them priority over you. So if we in that line together, and we both in that line, and you step over VIP, you understand what I'm saying? That's only valuable because I'm going to the club. Right. And you get in front of me.
That's right.
Now, if I devalue what
the club
own,
itself.
It makes the value out of it.
So, again, that's where I'm being intentionally vague about what I'm saying about a political movement.
Right.
The political movement can be anything. It could be Steve Coakley. Remember, he used to say, if we have a revolution, your debt goes away tomorrow. So it's selfish. Let's have a revolution. Why am I paying a mortgage to live in a house?
Absolutely.
Sure. Revolution tomorrow, my student loan debt goes away. Where are those anonymous people at? By the way.
Ready?
All these, where's Julian Assange at? All these hackers at? Hack that student loan database. You know what I'm saying? Like, I ask that all the time. But you make a good point. So the one thing you said about asking. All I want you to, if you haven't already, do me a favor. Read George Jackson, who I'm telling you is my, in this sense, guiding light, and then tell me if you think I'm asking for something. Email me.
I don't think Jonathan was asking either when it comes to the
course. No, hell no. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, right. A political movement is a demand. It is an insistence. What I'm saying is it is an unstoppable force that says this is not up for discussion anymore. We're not going to have poverty anymore.
But every time we demand, we get knocked back down.
So I get it. I get it.
And then I'll be
but
right back.
Let's be real. Every revolution we try to have,
yes,
it gets knocked back
yes.
down, the person gets taken out, and we're starting all over again.
Don't
so what's the deal?
I don't know. See, that's what I'm saying. I don't know. You're right. But all I'm saying is the revolutionary effort exactly. was correct.
That's what struck
so,
me. So,
now what definitely will not work, and this is where Marissa Baradaran's book is important. I think this is where my own contribution to this topic is important. What we know will not work and has never made in advance are these efforts at individual black business, consumption, purchasing, banking efforts. The history on this is much more clear. The revolutions you keep saying get knocked back, and you're right to say that, they have produced advances. These economic efforts have never produced an advance. That's what I'm saying. They don't, because today, as Claude Anderson says in his own book, we have the same 0.1% that we had in 1865. Baradaran starts her book the same way. The differences in the two is what they say is how they got there and what we can do about it. So the economic thing has not helped at all. And more to my point is it continues to mislead us into thinking that there is hope in it. We got to, again, Steve Coakley used to say hope is dope. We got to abandon the hope in this economic model survival thing.
Hello,
hello.
Hi, yeah.
Hello.
Yes, I just wanted to know, like, during the time of economic collapse, well, like, you know, the time of the dollar or whatever, the economic system, mm-hmm. would you suggest people invest money in precious metals like silver and gold?
The only reason I would say it doesn't make a difference, I'm not going to suggest one way or the other. The only reason I would say it doesn't make a difference is because black people collectively don't have enough money to invest in anything that's going to offer a return that's going to help the collective. So individually, you may be able to invest in some gold and come away okay. You might run off and try to do this Bitcoin thing or something else. You as an individual might be okay. But I'm only talking about the collective. I want to say very emphatically, I don't care about one more black person becoming rich or making it to the middle class. I don't even want that anymore. That doesn't help. It confuses everything. The collective is all I'm worried about. What is going to help all of us? And that isn't going to do it. And the reason it's not going to do it is because we don't have enough to invest in the first place. That's why the Bitcoin thing isn't going to help. To make money on investing, you have to have money to invest. That's why the wealthiest people pool their money to create the private equity groups that now own everything. Because they even understand that. And by the way, they're not even investing their own money. That's the other thing that they do that we don't do. They're investing other people's money. They're investing stocks and like their money. They're not even messing with that. We're the ones emptying our bank account to invest in some Boyce Watkins money scheme or some Bitcoin something. We're the ones doing that, and then that's why when it collapses, we don't have anything. Just look at it. When the stock market goes down, look at what happens to the richest people in the world. Almost nothing. Why? Because they own something else. Or the collapse ends up benefiting them because they buy up everything everybody else is losing. And that's why the Economic Policy Institute said Black America is in a permanent recession. The economy can be doing good, could be doing bad. Black people, it doesn't make you, we don't almost make, don't notice nothing. I ask you all, 8 years of Obama, did you notice any material change in your life? Really? No. A few people said, I feel good, it's nice to see a black family, you know, but materially, no, because he oversaw the greatest transfer of wealth to the richest 1% in the history of U.S. presidents. Happened under the savior of a black president. He gave more money to the rich than ever before. Yeah. He bailed out Wall Street. He guaranteed them $22 trillion. He gave, when the police killed people in Ferguson, he gave the police $20 million. They need more training. So let's give them more money. I was like, imagine that. Imagine if the poor neighborhood that suffered the police violent killing was invested with $20 million. What if he had gone into Sandtown, Winchester and said, here's $20 million to rebuild this community after Freddie Gray? No. They said, give more money to the police. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, sir.
Actually, I have two questions.
All right.
Well, first of all, when I found out about the event, I asked brother, that was on Tone Talk to my boy's watching, so it's good to finally see him in person.
Was I on
Tone?
Did I talk about boys?
He was debunking the same thing.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
First question would be, do you know where the 200-year racial wealth gap came from in regards to the origin of that? And secondly, knowing that these numbers exist, should we as a people redefine what wealth truly is?
The second question, that's interesting. On one hand, I want to say, yes, we should redefine wealth and say wealth should be like how we interact with each other, blah, blah, blah. But I don't want to, but I want to be careful there because I want us to understand economically what wealth is and is not. And we should understand that wealth is, simply put, wealth is what you make from other people's labor. And if you think about your life and the lives of the people you know, almost nobody, I don't even have to say almost, nobody you know makes money off of other people's labor. I'm happy to be corrected if anybody knows, but I don't think any of us know anybody whose sole income is off of other people's labor. So that's how we need to understand wealth. The other question about the wealth gap, I agree with what the authors of this report argue, that we should even start to question whether we're calling it a gap, because gap suggests that it's something that can be closed.
Right.
So the origins of studying the gap really are the origins of studying what happens to a group of people who are enslaved and colonized internally and then held out of wealth-producing processes. So I agree with it. We shouldn't call it a gap anymore. It should be, you know, permanent inequality, a study of the racial permanent inequality. Because the gap isn't even closing. It's getting worse.
They say the only way for us to get caught up.
Hold on 1 second, my brother.
Okay.
Here you go.
Dominant society would have to completely stop.
Oh, yeah.
And we keep moving.
Look, I even include stuff on this blog where, because one of the things I actually like to do from time to time whenever I can is listen to the people who are actually making these decisions. So I have a piece up there. I grabbed it from NPR Radio and annotated it and cut it up and edited it and put it up so people could listen. Nick Hanauer is this multi-billionaire venture capitalist. And he's on the radio, national public radio, talking about, man, if we don't enact some form of socialism and give some poor people some money, they're going to come and kill us. He said, this inequality thing is getting out of hand, and my fellow rich people don't seem to realize that it's making us unsafe. He's not some radical. He's like, I don't really care about poor people, but I care about them enough to say, actually, it's perfect for this. I care about them enough to say I don't want them coming to kill me because they're so poor and desperate. The same way here, buying power is not the power people actually have economically, but the power people have to further enrich those already in power.
Right.
So he's saying the people at Starbucks can't even afford, the people who work at Starbucks can't even afford to buy Starbucks coffee, and that's going to cause a situation where they come kill us. So we better find a way to give them a little bit, sprinkle some more stuff down. That, by the way, is why they call it a gap. That's a sprinkling of hope. Oh, because the gap can be closed. I just got to work harder. Or get my people to be less stupid and irresponsible.
So, I think the thing is so complex, and I think even that image there is part of the problem. So, just going back to what you were saying earlier. Now, when I look at this whole thing about white and black, I think that's also part of the problem. When I look at it, where we really, again, going back to what I said earlier, begin to believe that most white people are the quote unquote elite.
Yeah.
We believe white people are the elite, mm-hmm. when it's a certain segment of white people that are the elite, and even, you know, it's just a certain segment.
Mm-hmm.
But the, as you said earlier, is that those others believe they have something because they're white.
Mm, that's it.
So that's the thing. Keep you stay right there and think you got something because you're white, and you stay right there and yeah, you're supposed to be mad at them because they got something.
But, or the reason you're white and poor is because these black and brown people
right,
are
absolutely.
Doing what they're doing.
Right.
So, don't look at the rich white folks.
So yeah. So fight the guy who's chewing tobacco.
That's it.
I say tobacco.
That's it. That's it.
Right. So fight him.
That's it.
You know, so sometimes, you know, I think that we just have to really debunk a lot of myths.
Yeah.
You know, I'm working on a doctorate, and that's all I did was debunk myths.
Yeah.
And it's hard in African-centered, pan-African, black community. I got the red, black, and green flag out the front. But when you come in here, there's a different conversation. So the thing is, some of what we think is going to help actually perpetuates the problem. Because we need to go a little deeper than what we see.
That's right.
Because there's myths all day. And that was something else I was going to say, but I'm a little under the weather, so.
Yeah. That's all right. I mean, you know, one of the things that the reason I like to talk so much about propaganda is because the those in power have, you know, in that book, that Saunders book, she quotes one of these guys talking about, and it's such a I'm going to mess it up a little bit, but it's such a brilliant statement. They were saying, we don't put people we don't place people in positions around the world and tell them they have to say what we want to say. We create, she said, she quoted this guy saying, we create a facetious set of criteria that people will aspire to get those positions.
Absolutely.
That is such a sophisticated and brilliant way of manipulating. Right. So that's why when people are like, oh man, Jan, stop, you ain't, nobody put a gun in his head and made him go on TV and say that. Nobody put a gun to Don Lemon's head and Morgan Freeman's head and have them sit on CNN and have this long conversation about how black people should stop complaining about being poor because they could do what each of them have done.
Mm-hmm.
Did you all see that?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Morgan Freeman and Don Lemon sat up there on national television and had this extended conversation with each other about how black people should stop complaining. And Morgan was like, they should become a TV anchor like you. And Don Lemon was like, they could become an actor like you, Morgan.
Oh, shut up.
I'm not even going to look at another Morgan Freeman film again. I was like, you have taken playing the sucker role to a new level now.
Wow.
Like, your whole career has been being the magic Negro in film studies parlance.
Literally.
And now you're performing it on national TV.
Wow.
By actually telling people,
no.
You should be an actor like me. Imagine that. Morgan Freeman and Sam Jackson have been the only black men in like every movie. So every other black male actor out there trying to do that is like, where am I going to get a job? And then look at the fight that happened between the Iron Man fight between
Don Cheadle
and the light skinned dude. What's his name?
Terrence Howard.
Yeah, stop it.
They were beefing with each other over which Negro was going to get to play the Iron Man backup dude. I'm like, that's the whole point. There's no room for anybody. Even in the white world, the study this is a little dated, but in the 90s, they were like, it was something like 20 to 30% of all the money made in Hollywood from like 1990 to 2000 starred 7 actors. It was like Tom Hanks, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and 4 or 5 other people, all white men. So even in the white world, there's no room for all these actors. So it's like, so how are you going to sit there and tell 40 million black people that they should stop complaining about inequality because they could be like you and be like Don Lemon, the one other person anchoring a national, you know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? Like, how many,
How many spaces is it?
You're right. You're right. On my way over here, they were like, Jared, come make six figures hosting CNN. And I was like, nah. I like being poorer than that. I don't feel like it. I don't feel like it. I don't want it. You didn't get that offer? They didn't call you?
No.
Oh, wow. My bad. You must be tripping. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Thanks a lot for the presentation. I had a question about just that whole black buying power concept. How, I guess in their studies, how did they separate like black buying power from the United States? Since, you know, and I guess in their studies still saying you're black citizens, right? You still citizens. So how did they say this citizen's money? You know, what was, how did they separate that?
So one thing is, this is a video I have up on the blog, The Secret of Selling the Negro from 1954. And what it is the reason they separated it out and they say in this video is they're saying, they're almost saying, and I'm going to fill in a couple blanks, I'll editorialize, you can watch and see if you think I'm right. What they officially say is, black people are showing up more as consumers, they're getting a little more free. It's the 1950s now. They're getting jobs. They're making some money. You better get out there and sell to them. Mm-hmm. Or a number of different things might happen. One, they might set up their own economy, which won't make them rich, but it'll let them know that they are not in this economy. And psychologically, we can't let that happen. Mm-hmm. And two, whatever money is floating out there, you got to get it, not them. So it's just that. And then they do it, and that's what I was trying to say earlier. It's not just black people. They do this with every. I have a Google alert set up for buying power. So every day I get like 20 emails saying they're talking about buying power from everything from a company to a small city to a handful of white people to black American. It's only with us that this myth gets blown out of proportion and used against us. No other group, at least that I'm aware of, no other group have I seen is out there. Nobody is running around saying to any group of people, millennials, you would be so much more rich if you would pull your blah, blah, blah. They're not saying that. They're saying, no, millennials spend all this money, and this is how you market to them to get it. So they just wanted to isolate black America.
But like how it relates to wealth, and since...
But it doesn't.
But I guess in the falsehood, mm-hmm. if they're saying... You know, this buying power, this money, I guess, represents it. Isn't it like white folks that's giving the money to black folks in this sense? Since black folks aren't creating wealth, so isn't it really basically black people using the money that white people gave them? Since you're saying, you know, we're not creating wealth, so it's basically white people's buying power.
Well, that's interesting you say it that way. Yeah. The only reason they call it black buying power is because for a brief moment, you have a decision whether you're going to go to McDonald's or Burger King with that $5 in your pocket.
But it's still like their $5. It's just what you...
It's still going to McDonald's or Burger King.
Right.
So it's just like in media studies, the basics of media studies, they talk about agenda setting. And agenda setting isn't where we tell you what to think. It's where we tell you what to think about. And that's the same thing with shopping. So they're saying, I don't care. At the end of the day, I don't care if you go to McDonald's or Burger King. And by the way, if I showed you this other thing that I sometimes show in my presentations, if you go to theyrule.net, you can put up a... In fact, I'll just show it to you real quick. You can put up... you can just see how... Now, I'm a nerd, so I'll sit on this thing all day. You can play with this thing and see how everybody is interconnected in the business world and create all these web maps. So if you just take a company, let's just say Aetna, or this one, Affiliated Computer Services, I don't even know what that is, and you show the directors. Those are the boards of directors. And then you find...
Oh, wow.
Who... Oh, there's nobody on here connected to anything. It figures I would pick this one. All right, let me clear them. Let me just do one more that has something on it. Aetna. They just canceled my mother's insurance.
Mm-hmm.
85 years old.
Oh my God.
Yeah, we're going to deal with them now. Somebody going to get dealt with. Oh wait, I didn't mean to do that. Show the board. Okay, so this, I just start playing with it. So you can start to see through, you know, a company has a board of directors. And boards of directors set policy for that company. They hire the CEO, they determine what thing, and then they also sit on other boards. So they have what they call interlocking boards of directorates. Mm-hmm. So what are supposed to be competing companies are often linked up. Mm-hmm. So I just start to play with this, so it's like you just keep going. So Aetna's connected to CarMax. And then then you find somebody who's pictured as chubby, and then they're whoops, oh man.
Oh, that would jack me up.
That was good.
Gotta start over again. Anyway, you could just start playing with that, and you can start to see how everything is connected. So at the end of the day, all of our money ends up in the same 1%, or really 0.1% of the population, because they're all the major owners of all of these companies. And so it's like Coke and Pepsi are literally connected through interlocking boards of directors. So they're supposed to be the dominant competing soda companies. But at the end of the day, they're all working together.
Right.
So it's
but they give you the deception that it's a choice.
Of course.
Absolutely.
Of course, because when you because there are millions of sodas, right? So but they're all owned by two companies. So you can get Sprite or 7-Up. Or used to be, what is it, Dr. Pepper or Mr. Pibb? Or Mountain Dew or Mellow Yellow. Those are the competing, right? It was Sunkist was Coke, and then Crush was Pepsi, right? Something like that. The orange, whatever. They have, and then they give the appearance of offering you variety. The same thing happens with political leaders, politicians, etc. They're all funded by the same. Barack Obama got more Wall Street money than any other president in history, but he was somehow the revolution. That's the trick. So it's I think I forgot. What you mean. Yeah, sorry, yes, sir.
So I'm going to take you back a little bit when you were talking about colonialism.
Yes, sir.
And the property that Nigeria, you use as an example.
Yeah.
Explain that, but go into a little bit more detail as you said that Africa. Explain it.
What I was trying to say, I think this is the point, that I was just trying to say very quickly that the same process that created what we call Nigeria created Black America.
Did they happen at the same time?
More or less. I mean, it's the same imperial project occurring in different ways in different places. So I mean, in fact, So I sometimes mess with my continental Africans, particularly my classes, particularly anyone who tries to break away from my Pan-African fantasy, right? Mm-hmm. So when they're trying to be like, we're from the continent, so we're better, mm-hmm. I try to politely remind them that Black America is older than Nigeria, way older than Nigeria. Black America as an entity, and if we're considering ourselves a nation,
okay, I get.
We are way older than Kenya and Ghana and South Africa.
Because they came about in the 20s.
They came up in the 50s. Ghana was 1957. We've been here since 16-something.
Right.
Cool.
Right. Gotcha.
And one more point about that. The very names of these places. Nigeria is not an authentic African word or name. It was given to them by Lady Lugard and her husband, the white British colonial administrators. Thomas Jesse Jones, who set up our educational system here, set up the colonial education throughout the continent of Africa. So we're literally being taught by the same colonial process in our own respective place, which is why Africans on the continent are not taught about us accurately and vice versa.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then in each place, you can buy what is available to you. So if you're a Nigerian with a little bit of money, you might be able to get a little bit of land or a little bit of property, but that does not mean you're going to be able to invest in Chevron, which is basically controlling their oil, and it doesn't mean you're going to be able to invest in the coltan or whatever's being ripped out of the soil, and it doesn't mean that you're going to be able to own those processes and own those businesses that take that raw rock that's everywhere all over the place and shine it up and say it's rare and sell it to everybody for hundreds of thousands of dollars and say that you have to have one if you say you love your wife. I mean, that was the whole propaganda thing. To create love and diamonds so that they could sell this daggone rock that is literally everywhere. There's so many diamonds in the ground, it shouldn't be worth anything. But they steal it, put it in a vault in London, and say that it's rare. And then every dealer has to go to London to pick up their diamonds at the London office, says you're allowed to sell at Kay and Jared and everywhere else. And that's why people think it's rare and it's so expensive. Propaganda. Then they hire Marilyn Monroe and say diamonds are a girl's best friend on TV. And that's it. Once you see Marilyn wiggling it and shaking it, everybody's like, oh, well, of course I got to have a diamond now.
So propaganda becomes, as you said from the very beginning, the tool that keeps us from understanding the power that we have as a people to overcome all this mess.
And I would argue that the only power we actually have is in collective political movement, yes. Social movement, yes. That kind of thing. That's the power we have. They want us to think the power we have is in shopping and saving. That's not power.
And that $1 trillion that we don't have.
We don't have it. We just don't have it. And by the way, as I was trying to show you, Nielsen, one of the way Nielsen's, maybe I didn't do this part well enough. Nielsen concluded, part of the way they concluded that this buying power exists, one year they did a survey of 80,000 black shoppers during Christmas season. And they said, what did you buy? And then they tabulated those receipts and they said, look at all the money black people are spending. And then they extrapolated from that. They said, well, if 80,000 black people spent this X amount of dollars during Christmas, then 40 million of them must be spending this much. But it's not real. And then what you buy during the holiday season is not an example of your power.
Right.
It's an example of your desperate, degraded state. That's why we're out there beating each other up in lines for products to buy, to give to somebody, to say that we love them.
Right.
And we go into debt. The average black household has at least $6,000 in credit card debt. How can you be saying that somebody's powerful? Yes, sir.
So, it's no solutions. I've told them that you said you don't have the solutions, right? But I would imagine, just listening to you, have some theoretical framework or works that you're operating on. I heard Marx and all that. So I'm wondering, is it... Okay, what is your theoretical framework or works?
Okay.
But also, what does, I think I hear something, like the system needs to be re-something. You know, I won't put the word in there for you. So, I mean, I think in a nice way you've been kind of saying that. I just want to hear.
I appreciate that. In the original piece I wrote, I think I was very clear. I am. See, the only reason I hesitate is because I know words are loaded, and most critics hammer. Let me know. I am a radical Pan-Africanist. I am, which I accept the Nkrumah Ture's definition of that, that radical Pan-Africanism is that all African people are united in one and should have a collective political movement that reclaims the continent of Africa under scientific socialism. The simple point is that, and I agree with Ture again, there are only two ways to have economics, to run economics in society. Either all the wealth is owned by a private group, capitalism, where all the wealth is shared among the people, socialism. And those two words have been twisted and misinterpreted and ill-defined and ill-represented and dismissed as either Eurocentric or something else. But I think that's really as simple as it, that's where I am. So I said I'm with George Jackson, who claimed socialism. Cabral claimed socialism. But I don't claim it in the non-racialized sense. I mean, I claim it as Fanon claimed it. I claimed it as Nkrumah claimed it, as Malcolm claimed it, as a matter of fact. Which is why I would have liked to have been able to have Malcolm comment on this issue later in life, when he was more aggressively critiquing capitalism. I don't think he made the same conclusion about buying power. But I try not. Sometimes I'm hesitant in bringing all that out because I don't want to get bogged down and have people miss the point. But essentially, I am saying that we cannot have, whether you call it socialism or not, if the wealth is not being consciously redistributed to where people need it, we're not going in the right direction. So on some level, we need to have some. I mean, like I said, we've created all the wealth already.
I mean, I think that's at least, if you didn't throw any isms in there, just saying that would be suffice. Because so I guess.
But I like to claim communism. I like to claim socialism because I think those terms have been intentionally misdefined.
I'm not saying that.
No, I just want. Yeah, but I like. To, no, I'm not.
I'm saying just to. Yeah. Just because people say, so what do we do?
Yeah.
I mean, just saying that in and of itself would suggest that. Yeah, the system needs to change.
Yeah.
So, buying it means necessary.
Absolutely.
We change the system.
Yes.
Right? So, in war, it's going on all different levels.
Yeah.
You know, mentally, physically, spiritually, all types of
things. Absolutely. Right?
So, yeah. So, it's all about...
But to me, I'm just saying, this to me, and I'm often accused of this, that is a vague... Saying revolution is just vague, so people are usually critical of me. That's what I was trying to preempt for saying. You said don't invest in black banks right. as a solution to our problems, but then what are you saying to do? And then all you have is this vague political movement thing.
I think the solution is you said it. Debunk the myths,
okay.
and then the revolution will begin.
I like your version.
You said it.
So Bernie Sanders is on the right track.
See, that's a little more complicated for me. See, I think Bernie Sanders was another hustle. And I think Bernie Sanders did a disservice to our understanding of what socialism is. Now, on the one hand, he was on the right track and he tapped into the righteous feelings of a bunch of people in this country. But the hustle was that he knew he was doing it in the Democratic Party, which was never going to allow him to have that nomination. So he hustled us to bring us, as Bruce Dixon of Black Agenda Report said, to sheepdog us back into the Democratic Party, and we should be abandoning both of them. But it was to give us hope. And then we went back to the Democratic Party and ended up voting for Hillary, who, as bad as Trump is, I still am convinced would not have been much better. Her expressed policies, foreign policy, economic policy, would have been... She would have probably had us in Iran war with Iran faster than him. Mm. So I don't. So that's what, and then his definition of socialism, like he didn't really explain. He never took the podium on national TV and said, this is what I mean by socialism. He just kept saying things like.
Who said free education for everyone?
Sure.
College education.
Sure.
Oh, one example.
Sure. But for instance, well, maybe I was looking for something that he couldn't do. But as I've tried to point out here, if he had said, look, we already generate $23 trillion every year.
You might not even know that.
If he doesn't know that, then he shouldn't have been running for president. He shouldn't be a senator. He shouldn't be. He shouldn't have anybody's attention if he didn't know that. But what I think he did know was that he could not win the nomination in the Democratic Party, but he wanted to be on TV. And the Democratic Party wanted him to be on TV because that was the most radical thing they could bring after Obama, and they knew Hillary was a bad candidate, and they knew nobody wanted to vote for her. So the way they kept all those people tied to the Democratic Party was let him run. And if you read the WikiLeaks stuff, they killed his campaign. The Democratic Party killed his campaign. So that's why when people try to blame Trump and blame the rednecks for Trump and all this other stuff, I'm like, no, the Democratic Party killed... I agree with Glenn Ford 100% in Black Agenda Report. He said the Democratic Party would prefer to lose with Bernie, lose with Hillary, than win with Bernie. Mm. All the reports showed Bernie would have beat Trump in a general election. Mm-hmm. I think he would have killed Trump. Oh, yeah. All the numbers showed it. Yep. All the numbers showed it. But the Democratic Party was like, he's too radical for us. We don't want what he's talking about. That's why he's always been an independent. He's not even in the party for real. He just ran on their ticket so that he could get the money and get on TV.
Last question right here.
All right. So, I mean, it is Malcolm's birthday. So yeah, when he went to, I guess, Africa, mm-hmm. was he trying to create that political front?
Oh, absolutely. And not just what he was doing throughout the continent of Africa, it was what he was doing in this country on the low, working with the Organization of Afro-American Unity. He was developing everything from a political party to underground guerrilla warfare organization. That's the part people don't talk about. Like Malcolm, that's part of why he was traveling throughout the continent of Africa. And what he was very clear on was that if we don't align ourselves with other people struggling outside of this country, we're not going to get anywhere. So this is, again, why I don't even care if people have deep-seated animosity towards other groups of Africans around the world. Strategically and tactically, if African people don't link up, it's a wrap. It will never get any better. Any effort towards reparations for black people in this country, I don't think can be worked at all without a broader movement. In fact, this is where global, but I think, honestly, this is where I got some pushback for this, but I do believe it. Tactically, calling for reparations only for black people is a waste of time and a complete useless effort that I think people are manipulating for, many people are manipulating for bad intentions. There are many good people trying to do good work. Tactically, I think it's wrong because you're never going to get a public policy move in this country to give money only to black people. Never, never, never. And then I also don't want money going just individually to black people. That's not going to help. I would want major bailouts of student loan debt, mortgages, land purchases, generational investment. So my great-grandchild that I don't even will never know should have something hooked up for her or him. That's what I'm talking about. And the only way to do that is if you make it a national movement for everyone. And this is why I keep saying this thing called socialism is the only answer. The only move is if we would say strategically, reparations for black people has to be connected to reparations for Latinos, poor whites, indigenous people, whoever the hell else is being ripped off on whatever level. We all need it, and we need it in the form of massive structural givebacks.
Sounds like revolution.
That's the only way. This thing of only black people, white people are never going to do that. White people are never going to sign a bill that says black people should get $1 billion.
Yeah.
And then if they did, they would say the only way you can have it is if we give individual checks to individual black Americans who would then do what?
Wait, get right back to
it. Yeah. When we had your colleague in maybe about a few months ago, Dr.
Wimbush. That's my man. Look, Dr. Wimbush is my man, and again, I would put him in clearly in that category of people who are on the righteous side of that argument. And I'm only saying, as I was saying about the other people that I'm mentioning, I'm only critiquing that one tactical Absolutely. Thing. The concept is righteous, and of course we should get. Oh my God! But think about what would happen if you start the reparations conversation. Why Europe is never willing to do it is that you would end up logically leading to the conclusion that everything Europe has to be returned,
right?
And all of this wealth has to be returned, and that's never going to happen. Because why did they do it in the first place?
To get that wealth
by any means necessary. And so let's be fair. Let's give the devil his due, right? Slavery, colonialism, and mass manipulation of hundreds of millions of people is hard work. And with all respect, I mean it. Like, I actually sincerely respect the effort that is done, even if it's being conducted by my enemies. They are doing a remarkable job. So they work very hard. They even went to war with each other.
Absolutely.
To get to where they are now. They're never giving that up because we've asked nicely or because, you know, they say, y'all deserve some money.
You know what you write.
So last point, my daughter, my sixth grade daughter came to me the other day and she was like, first she said, this is the best part, she said, Daddy, I think I'm finally seeing what you were saying about race in this country and all the people breaking up into groups. She said, when I was in elementary school and it was all black and brown, I didn't really see it, but now that there's all these significant groups of white people, I can see like all these pockets of the white people here, the black people here, the Latinos here, and everybody's hostile. And then she said, this group of white girls said something teasing me in the cafeteria. And she said, I went over to him and was like, what's up? And then she said, there was like an argument, disagreement, whatever, and she didn't get what she wanted. And I said, that's the point, though. I said, on the one hand, you have your father's emotionalism, but that's not strategically wise. You're never going to get the response you're looking for.
Ah, shit.
In other words, you're never going to have that movie or TV moment where you say to the white girl, whoever, oh, why did you say that to me? That was really hurtful and mean. And she says, you know what? You're right. I'm sorry. Let me get my girlfriends together and we're going to fix this. And you know what? That's never going to happen. Even if they realize they're wrong, they're going to respond in hostility just as to save face. The same thing politically. They're never, like, the appeals have been made. Who can speak better than Du Bois and whoever in explaining the problem? They don't care. They did this on purpose.
Right.
So that's why I say, you know, the George Jackson thing. The fight has to occur, however, whatever form it's gonna take. I don't know, but if we're talking about the collective, and not a handful of us doing okay, that's what's gonna have to happen.